This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is October 24th in the year 2000. I'm in Mercile Lee's office in Bascom Hall, and we're going to be talking about her involvement with the Chancellor's Scholarship Program. Before we get to that, Mercile, let's go a little bit back a little bit into your past and talk about a little bit about your childhood and your schooling as a way of setting up the your involvement with the Chancellor Scholarship Fund. Talk about your parents and your siblings and your early life, and where was it? Chase City, Virginia? Is that where?
That is correct. I'm one of 12 children. My parents knew when they married that they wanted to have a large family.
And they did.
My father clearly made that statement that he wanted 12 children like his siblings had. My mother at the time was planning to be a teacher, but as their relationship developed, he made his wishes known. She made a career-limiting decision.
Did he sort of give her an ultimatum?
Yes, he did.
One or the other?
Yes, that if she married him, he wanted her to be his wife, companion, and the mother of his children.
Mm-hmm. And mothering 12 children is a full-time job, is
yes,
it not?
Indeed, yes, indeed it is.
Okay.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about your early schooling, your elementary school.
Well, school was certainly very important to all of us with older siblings who had gone. We all looked forward to beginning school and then, of course, to the beginning of the school year every year thereafter. Our parents had impressed on us the importance of education. Perhaps fortunately for them, we were all basically quite bright and did well in school. That was an expectation, and we knew it, but we also enjoyed it. And my father in particular told us early on that he expected us to get a good education, and he always considered that our responsibility, regardless of what teachers did or did not do.
Mm-hmm. What was your parents' level of education?
My mother finished high school, and in those days she could have started teaching as soon as she completed high school. And of course, she would have gone on to get other courses as she continued.
Mm-hmm.
We're not altogether sure about my father's. He left home, well, his parents died, and he lived with an older brother for a period of time, and then finally, as a teenager, 13, 14 years old, as best we can figure, decided to move out on his own, and came to Virginia. He was born in North Carolina, and started working in the sawmill industry. And continued in that from being an employee to finally owning his own sawmills. He had two, and hiring quite a number of people to work for him.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So we grew up, first of all, with his working in the lumber industry. And then as we kept increasing in number, and we were growing up, people started contacting him to see if they might employ us on their farms or in their homes, because those were the jobs that would have been available in a small town. And he decided early on, but made clear to us at that time, that he did not want us working for anybody else, and then he finally said he didn't want us working for white people, that we were not going to be their maids or their cooks or their farmhands, and that if we did any of that work, we were going to do it for ourselves. So he bought a farm.
There you go. That's one way of doing it.
When I was about 11 years old. And so we moved to this farm, and of course his brothers, who I'm sure were his models, also had large families, they had large farms, and so this was something that he was going to provide for us as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved to the farm when I was about 11, and we started farming. We hadn't known much about farming until that time. And because my older brother had worked in the sawmill with my dad for a number of years before he went into the Navy. Mm-hmm. And the rest of us had not worked until then. And so it was an interesting experience.
I'll bet it was. What crops did your...
Tobacco and corn were the mm-hmm. larger crops, but tobacco was the profit-making mm-hmm. part of the farming. And so we had, you know, the usual farm animals and things like that. And we did very well, I think, basically with the tobacco until he decided to plant cotton. Because, again, that was one of the things that my uncles had in North Carolina. Mm. But I think he soon realized that we were not going to be cotton pickers no matter what. Mm. And so he finally ended up paying us to pick it. Mm. And that was the way we had to earn our money for the county fair one year. Mm-hmm. But throughout the time that we were on the farm, when he needed to get, you know, major stuff done, he would bring some of his employees from the sawmill to help get mm-hmm. the tobacco crop in and to harvest the corn and stuff like that. So we always kind of had others working along with us as we did this.
So you were going to school, obviously, the whole time that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yes.
Just a couple of words about high school. How big was it? What courses did you take? Any particular teachers who influenced
you? Now, that's
you?
Going way back. I think if I were to talk about teachers who influenced me, I'd probably start with elementary
okay.
school, because that was a two-room school.
Mm, my.
And we...
K through five and one. Yeah. How did they divide them, do you remember?
Well, it was, you started in first grade, so that would be sixth through eighth grade.
Okay. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Or seventh, sixth through, I forgot. Yeah. I mean, I don't mean sixth, first through seventh, I think was the way it was.
Okay.
And so there were two teachers in the school, and my father paid those teachers to give us rides to school. Mm. Before we moved to the farm. And so we knew the teachers, you know, really quite well. And, of course, my parents knew them. And so there was a good feedback link with their letting our parents know how well we were doing, or perhaps not doing. And early on, I had, as did my other siblings, considerable feedback from the teachers and also from my parents that, you know, I was bright, that I was expected to do well, and reinforced for that mm-hmm. by the teachers. And it was that I thoroughly enjoyed school, and we all did. I mean, it wasn't thinkable not to, that this was something that we wouldn't enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents always had us doing study time at home. I mean, they would say to us, don't you have some homework to do?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we got accustomed early on to having study time before we went to bed at night. We also all had chores of a variety of sorts that we needed to do. But you did your homework, and then, of course, we always did everything as a large family because we had built-in friends.
Mm-hmm.
So our siblings became our best friends. And we compete with each other and work and play.
What number were you of, the 12?
I was the fifth.
You're the fifth. So you were a middle child.
Yes.
Well, I can sympathize with that. I'm four of seven, so I know exactly where we fit in this world.
Yes.
Did you have any subjects in high school that you were particular, that you enjoyed more than others?
No, again, I think I enjoyed all of them. And I, you know, I just remember that most of it was pretty easy for me. And I had the usual courses, but no particular one stood out more than
mm-hmm.
another.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we were also very actively involved in church and went regularly both parents would for a while, but then as my father developed health problems, he didn't go as much, but my mom certainly, and he would take us and come back and pick us up. But my mom and all of us were very active in church. Mm-hmm. And so that, and the church was adjacent to the school. That school building is now owned by the church. And that's where they serve meals and that kind of thing now. So that two-classroom school still exists. And it's been really quite nice to have it. Now, I didn't go to, I think I went up maybe a couple of years to the one that stands now, but one earlier was destroyed. And so I think that perhaps my direction in life was influenced greatly by school, my family, and the church.
Mm-hmm. The triangle there, the three, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And being actively involved in church and, assuming leadership positions and teaching Sunday school and, being there every Sunday, that was just a very integral part of our lives. You didn't miss school, you didn't miss church. And as I began to think about what I wanted to do, my father always kind of started asking us early on, as did people in the community, what do you want to do when you grow up? And so I knew that by the time I got to be about 13, that I needed to be prepared to tell him what I wanted to do.
You needed to be prepared?
Yes.
Okay.
I had to think it through.
Okay.
Because he would want
to know
an answer.
Yeah, interesting.
And my father had a shorthand way of talking to us about lots of things. He, as I said, always stressed the importance of education and that it was the only way, and he and my mother were together on this, it was the only way we could ever get ahead, it was the only way we could ever make something of ourselves, mm-hmm. the only way we could ever contribute mm-hmm. anything, etc., etc. And he had talked on a couple of occasions about the fact that he wanted all of his children to earn college degrees. But he wasn't quite sure how he was going to be able to do it. And so when we got then, as I said, into early teens, he would be trying to gauge what each of us wanted to do and whether we wanted to go on. And if we wanted to, then obviously he was going to do everything possible mm-hmm. to see that we had that opportunity. But with the girls, it was kind of interesting because his question in shorthand often was, what will it be, books or boys?
Mm.
And if you said books, then that meant you wanted to go on with your education. And if you were interested in boys, then that meant you wanted to get married and have a family. And so if you were inclined to want to have a family and be married, then that meant for him that he wasn't going to be investing his money in your going to college. So all of us chose to go to college.
Really?
Except my oldest brother, that they knew would not go. Mm-hmm. And he's the one who went into the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
But once we got started, everybody was geared toward going to college. And we did.
Wow, that's amazing. That's a lot of people going to college.
And especially in a time when there were no federal programs of support, parents had to pay the entire cost. And there were those times when he had three of us in college at the same time. So when I, tell you that he probably worked himself to death, in addition to his health problems, it, begins to make a great deal of sense as to how that could have happened. But he was not going to have his children deprived of anything. And again, he and my mom were just, real partners in this. She kept the books for his business and filed all of the tax papers and things that needed to be done, assisted with purchases and loans and mm-hmm. all of that, as she did for her brothers and a few other people who also started to develop their own businesses in that time. So I grew up with two loving parents, two hard-working parents, and 11 siblings.
Wow. You graduated from high school.
Mm-hmm.
How did you determine what college to go to? Were all of you, was your father involved in that decision? Tell me about that part of your growing up.
My father was very much involved in what happened to all of us mm-hmm. at any time. I guess I hadn't paid quite as much attention to the level of his involvement with my oldest sister. She had had what they call pneumonia at that time, and they said that it settled in her heart. And so she was not well from that time on. And so she was the first to go to college, and so they wanted her to go close to home. And she went for one semester and then became seriously ill and was not able to return and died a couple of years later. So then the next two sisters went to the college that was related to the high school that we had attended. It's the same high school that my mother attended. It was called Thyne, T-H-Y-N-E, Institute. And it was established by the Presbyterians, one of their missionary schools. And they also were responsible for Knoxville College in Tennessee. So a number of our teachers had, high school teachers, had attended Knoxville. And so when they were talking to the high school students about schools to attend, that was one that obviously that they would talk about. Now, there were other schools in the state that certainly they could have considered. But my two older sisters went to Knoxville College. And so when I came along, because here were three girls right together, my father just kind of assumed that I was going to go there too. And then we talked and I said I didn't want to go there. So he gave me his reasons for why I should go. And I was giving him my reasons for why I wanted to go someplace else. And we had some very interesting discussions with neither one of us giving in. Sort of holding our ground. He would tell me that I needed to go to Knoxville College because my sisters had made a name for the family and that would be beneficial for me. And I would say to him, but just like they made a name for the family there, I can make a name for the family wherever I go. And I didn't want to go to Knoxville College, and so we discussed the benefits and the merits of the schools, and I'd say, but there are other good schools. And I wanted to major in religion. And of course I could have done that at Knoxville College, but at that time my position with him was that that was a Presbyterian school. We were Baptist, and I wanted to go to a Baptist college. So the one that I considered, again, my principal was a graduate of Virginia Union University, and I had a Latin teacher also with whom I had good relationships. And we were fortunate in a lot of ways because the teachers, wherever we were, liked us because we were bright and well-mannered and that kind of thing. So they weren't going to have any problems with us in terms of our being disruptive or any of that. And so we were then, as I said, reinforced in terms of the abilities that we had and exploring with us the kinds of things that we might do. So when I made it clear to my high school principal that I wanted to go to Virginia Union, which was where he had gone. Of course, he was delighted with that and said that he would help me. And I'm not even sure how he helped me, but said that he would anyway. And I was valedictorian of my graduating class, and so I got a scholarship. But back to the discussion with my father, we went on and on with that from the time that I graduated until somewhere pretty close to August. And neither of us again had changed our positions. Every time he'd bring it up, he'd say, I should go to Knoxville. I'd say, I didn't want to go there. And so finally I got to the place where I said to him that I really didn't want to go to Knoxville. I wanted, and I wasn't saying there was anything wrong with the school, but I wanted to go to Virginia Union. And so he said that he, after a time, would not pay my tuition and bills for me to go there because I should go for my sister's work. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, then if you won't do that, I will work and save my money until I can go. And he said that I couldn't work for anybody because I was too young. And furthermore, he said, you wouldn't earn much money anyway. So I said, well, it doesn't matter. I would work and save my money until I could go. And he said, but you're too young to work for anybody. You can't work for anybody. And I said, well, then I'll work for you. You hire other people, so I will work for you. And he said that he wouldn't pay me. He'd only give me, I said, you'll give me something. And he said, nickels and dimes. And I said, well, I'll save the nickels and dimes until I can go. And so finally, my older brother, who had now come back from the military, said to him one day, you know, you and Marcelle just keep disagreeing on where she's going to go to school. And he said, you're not giving in, and she's not giving in. And he said, I wouldn't like for Marcelle not to go to school next fall, and I will help her. Mm. Well, my father took great interest and some umbrage with that, I'm sure, and said, how can you help her? You're not taking care of yourself, so where are you going to get money to help her? So finally, my father called me one day and said, all right, we need to work this thing through. So he said, you know where I want you to go? And I said, yes, you told me that, I know. But I don't want to go there. And so he'd have me state my reasons again. And so finally he said, well, I'm going to let you go, but I'm going to have some stipulations. And so before I heard him, I said, sure. I couldn't imagine what he was going to tell me I had to do. And I don't even remember much of them, but, you know, there were things that were easy enough mm-hmm. for me to do. And so I said, fine. And so he said, well, you'd better hurry up and get your application in, or you will not be admitted. So I said, well, just a minute. So I ran up to the bedroom, came back, and presented him my letter of acceptance.
You'd applied
with the award of a scholarship. And he said, when did you do this? And I showed him the date on the letter. I said, look at the date on the letter. And he said, but I had told you you couldn't go. And I said, but I knew you'd change your mind later on. So that's why I did. So I went to Virginia Union.
To study religion?
Yes.
How long were you at Virginia Union?
4 years. Part of his philosophy also was that if we were going to college, we went there with the dedication and commitment that was necessary, and that we would complete our degrees in 4 years, no summer school. Mm-hmm. We did that. Mm-hmm. And again, he would tell us that the quality of our education was our responsibility, and he had this little saying, which I still use with students, that the quality of your education is your responsibility. Mm-hmm. Ideally, you should learn with your professors. But there are those times, and they can be numerous, when you learn without your professors, so you take your learning into your own hands, or there are those times that you learn in spite of your professors. Mm-hmm. So my father never would allow us to tell him that somebody didn't like us or didn't treat us well. The focus was always on what role we had and whatever it was that had happened to us. So we learned early that it never paid to say to him, well, I didn't get a good grade because the teacher didn't like me. And of course, we didn't have many of those experiences anyway, so it didn't happen. But he almost made that an impossible response for us from the very beginning. So when I went to Virginia Union, I wanted to major in religious education. And the other part of the conversation that my father and I had for quite a number of years was my interest in majoring in religion and wanting to be a minister. And his knowledge that women he discouraged me from considering becoming a minister because at that time women were not regarded well in any area, but certainly not in the ministry. And there was the feeling that God only called men, not women. And he said to me on a number of occasions, because I had been speaking publicly since perhaps I was about 13 or 14, somewhere around in there, at church and at conventions and stuff like that. And so he said that I would not be allowed to even stand at the pulpit and speak. That the ministers would have me stand down on the floor. That is, not on the pulpit.
Because you were a woman.
Because I was a woman. And he said, it will have nothing to do with the quality of your speech or your sermon. It's just the fact that you are a woman. He said, I have no doubt that you will be a very good speaker or preacher, whichever. But you will not get the opportunities that you need. And so he kept saying that he really didn't feel comfortable with my plan to become a pastor. So I said, well, then I would do what was the next best thing, which was closest to being a minister. Because I'd always thought that I wanted to be a minister, a teacher, or counselor. And I would re-rank those things, professions, time and again, and I could never get rid of the three. So I kept those three out there. I could only shift their positions, but I couldn't eliminate them. And so I decided then that I wanted something that would prepare me, a major, that would prepare me for doing something in these three areas. And I always knew that I didn't want to do either of them full time, but some combination thereof. And so when I got to Virginia Union, the major that was there that I could pursue was religious education. And within a short period of time, I had established relationships with professors and staff members, president of the college, all of whom were informal mentors for me, I'm sure, in lots of ways. We didn't think of them that way in those days. But the head of the program of religious education was Dr. Rebecca Calloway, and she sort of adopted me as her daughter. And so I spent a good deal of time with her and interacting with her. There was a secretary of the Baptist Convention who had his office on campus, and within a short period of time, he'd heard me speak somewhere and would see me in the building going to and from classes, and so we developed a relationship there. And then the president of the college, same kind of thing. So on those small liberal arts campuses, you sort of get to know, you know, most people. And they get to know you, because even before you take classes with certain professors, you've met them in a variety of settings. And so again, it was a very affirming supportive and deeply caring environment that I went to.
How very fortunate you were.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And again, people who recognized my abilities and were, you know, like my parents saying, well, what are you going to do? You know, what do you want to be? And what's next? You know, that kind of thing. And I enjoyed college a lot. Didn't have to do a lot of studying. Grades weren't important to me. And that's an interesting story when you think about what I'm doing now.
Yeah, sure is.
But there's a little anecdote that I think is of interest. When I was going away to college, I announced to my parents that I was not going to be trying to make the honor roll. And
you announced to your parents that you weren't necessarily concerned about making honor rolls and
right.
things like that. Go ahead.
That I knew that I could do it, but that I was going to college to learn about life.
Hmm.
And I'm sure they said something, but I don't even remember what it was. And so at the end of the first semester, when my sisters and I were back at home, and my mother had a conversation with my two older sisters about their grades.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sitting there while she's doing this with the two of them and thinking she's doing it in order of our ages. So she talked to the older sister first, and then to the next, and then I was the next. And when she finished with my second sister, I was ready for her to start talking to me. And she didn't. So I said, well, aren't you going to talk to me about my grades? And she said, no. And I said, well, I got a C. And she said, I know. And I said, well, you talk to Hattie about hers, and you're not going to talk to me about mine? And she said, no. Because your father and I know that you could be earning all A's if you wanted to. You said you weren't going to. That you were going to learn about life. So, what is there for me to say? So, then, I did well enough to get by without much studying, and I had the philosophy at that time, if I can earn B's without studying, why bother?
Mm.
And that I don't brag about it, I don't often tell it to anybody. But it wasn't until I started thinking more about what I really wanted to do that I knew I had to change. And so when I decided I wanted to go on to grad school my junior year, then I started making the honor roll so that I'd have the grades that I needed to get into grad school.
What was your intention? What did you intend to do in graduate school? Had you made up your mind yet?
Again, I wanted to...
Teaching, counseling, mm-hmm. still religion, mm-hmm. religious education.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And didn't know how I was going to do it because I had all of these younger siblings who needed to go to college. And certainly my parents couldn't afford to be paying for a second degree for me when here were all these others yet to come. So I had to kind of figure out how I could do it. And the summer that I was graduating, my president then, Dr. Proctor, Samuel D. Proctor, had invited me and another member of my class to go to Connecticut for an American Baptist camp. Hmm. He was the chaplain, and we were to be two student counselors.
A summer camp?
Mm-hmm. And as we were driving to Connecticut, he was always the teacher, consummate teacher. And so he said, well, Marcel, what are you, and I said, what are you going to do next year? No, he asked, I'm sorry, he asked Lillian first, and so she told him. And she had been involved in a relationship, so she was going to get married and mm-hmm. become a teacher. And so when she finished talking to her about that, then he said, well, Marcel, what about you? And I said, you're asking me the wrong question. So he said, all right, what question should I ask? So I said, ask me what I want to do. So he said, all right, what do you want to do? And then, of course, I answered the question I told him was not the right question. I said, well, let me tell you first that I have an opportunity next year to teach in my home county, because I had given the devotional meditation at the district teachers meeting. One of the sisters just over mm-hmm. me was an assistant. And at the end of that session, the superintendent of my home county was asking people, where is that young woman who gave the meditation mm-hmm. this morning? I want to meet her. And so when he came over and told me who he was and how impressed he was with what I had done, and he wanted to know, when was I graduating? And I told him, what's your major? And I told him, and he said, I want you to know that you have a job in this county. Mm. I like what I saw there today. And he said, you don't have to go through any interviews. Just give me a call when you have graduated, and you will have a job in this county teaching next fall. So I said, I can do that. But that's not what I want to do. So he said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to go to graduate school. But I cannot ask my parents to help me. I need to be able to do this myself. So he said, well, you really want to do this? And I said, yes. And he said, how badly? And I said, it's what I want to do. And I will do what I need to go. And he said, would you work? And I said, of course I'll work. He said, would you scrub floors? And I said, yes. Would you wash dishes and wait tables? I said, yes. Would you clean toilets? And I said, yes. And he said, then you really want to go. And I said, I do. So I will work. I'll do any kind of work to pay for my expenses, because I cannot ask my parents to help me. So he said, well, just bet me that we won't have something worked out by the time camp is over. And I said, no, I didn't want. He said, oh, come on, you know, bet me. See my challenges. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And so he said, anyway, excuse me. So he said, you want to continue in religion? And I said, yes. So he said, all right, we're going to work this thing through while we're out here. So while we were at camp, and I was working with my group one morning, and he came over and said, do you have somebody who could take care of this group for 5 minutes? And I said, sure. So I asked one of the campers to do it. And he said, I just want you to come and listen to this young woman, and you can go right back, and we'll talk later. So we went over to another group, and this young woman, shorter than I, was speaking, and she was impressive. And so he said, okay, what do you think? And I said, well, I like what I hear from her. So he said, okay, we'll talk about it later. So later that day, we talked, and he said, I'm impressed with her too. And she's gone to a seminary here in Connecticut, in Hartford. And he said, I've done some checking on, some research, and it's well thought of. And he said, that might be, you know, the kind of place, and she's in the same program that, you know, you're considering. So he said, let's talk with her and get some more information. So we did. And on our way back, we stopped by the seminary and went in and had an appointment with the dean. And he and I talked to him about what I wanted to do. And he told him my family background, 1 of 12, and that I didn't want my parents to have to finance my education because I already had 3 siblings who would be in college the next year, and that there were still others to come. And told him what he knew about me, and said that the university was going to give me a scholarship because they were expecting me to come back and serve on the faculty there at some point. So the dean was really very helpful and encouraging. So we got all the materials that we needed for the application and also for financial aid. And I filled them out and sent them in, and I was accepted. So I went there to work on my master's, and knew then that I was not going to be a director of Christian education in the church, but rather that I was going back to the university campus. And so to the extent possible, I sort of geared my focus in graduate study to that. But did, you know, the usual kind of field work that others do. And completed my master's there, and the next year I was offered a position on the faculty at my alma mater. So I worked there then for a number of years, teaching initially, and then a combination of teaching and counseling.
This is at Virginia Union we're talking about, right? And what were you teaching?
We had a course that was called Humanities, an interdisciplinary course. It was really the history of Western civilization, and it was a long-term course, I think a 2-year series, as I may or may not remember. But at any rate, it was tracing the history of development of Western civilization, and you brought in all of the, you know, the literature, the art, and all of the other disciplines.
Interdisciplinary, right.
So it was right down, you know, my line in terms of the way I had approached my education, and so that was really a fun thing to do. And then did some counseling and worked in residence halls, lived in residence halls as a matter of fact, and served as a director. We had on our campus a separate building for small, for those of us who were religious education majors. So I had lived in that, in one of the houses. It was a new one when I came back. And there, you know, we were, well, taught lots of stuff informally. So we had our majors in religious education, but we all lived, the young women lived in this house. And we prepared and served meals together and learned how to do all of that. So it was really sort of training in the social graces as well as, you know.
That was a very common thing on campuses for women. We did that here with our home improvement house, same kind of thing. Did you enjoy both teaching and counseling?
Yeah, always had the combination, And so I was on the faculty there for a number of years, and then started working during the summer because we had options as to whether we taught in the summer or did not, and I kind of didn't want to teach in the summer, and perhaps, I'm not even sure that I could have, I know I didn't want to, because I wanted to do something else in the summer. So, the director of our food services told me that there was this, well, it's kind of resort on the York River. It was a house that actually was a mansion that was owned by Morton, who was the second president of Tuskegee University. And this group of professional men had purchased it from the family, and they operated it as a summer resort, so they would go there for the summer for vacations. And so I started managing that and did it for about 3 summers. And with a small staff, you know, we'd maintain the rooms and get them prepared for guests, and we'd cook and serve the meals. And of course, when we didn't have guests, then we had some relaxing time and we could enjoy some of the same things that they did, although we didn't have their money. So that was a really good experience, and you got to meet, you know, some of the top people from around the country. And almost always people wanted to know what I did, you know, when I wasn't there, and would say to me, if you're ever ready to leave Virginia Union, you know, let me know, because we'd like to have you come and work on this campus, or I'd like to have you come and work on my firm, or whatever. And when finally I was ready to leave Virginia Union, I got in touch with the president that next summer when he came of Spelman College, and said that...
This was somebody that you had met at Yorktown?
Mm-hmm. Okay. He'd been there 2 previous summers, and each time said to me that he was very impressed with me, and if I were ever ready to leave, he wanted me to get in touch with him first. And others have said similar things. Mm-hmm. And so the next summer when he came, I told him that I was now about ready to leave. And did he still, you know, have this offer that he had extended to me before? And he said, well, yes, he did. So he offered me the position of Dean of Women. Mm. And I was one of the youngest at that time. And so I went to Atlanta and served as Dean of Women.
That must have been very exciting.
It was.
Atlanta.
It was. Within the Atlanta complex, you know, there's Morehouse, Spelman, and Clark University. And there were 3 universities just across the street from each other. Morehouse is for men, and Spelman was for women, and Clark was co-ed. Mm. So it was really one of the unique black cultural centers,
right,
and still is.
How exciting.
Country. Yeah. So I stayed there for 3 years and married and left and went to Albany State and worked there as an associate dean of students for a couple of years. And then we decided to go back to graduate school. Both my husband and I were going, and so we started working on that. I had been invited to come back to Hartford for the doctorate, and he was going to go somewhere in the area to work on his doctorate. But that didn't happen because he was offered the job that he said had been the one that he'd wanted all of his life, which was the director of athletics at Albany State College. So he decided to stay, and I said, we made the decision to do this, and I'm going. And of course, he wanted me to go. So I went back to Hartford with my son, who was not quite 2 years old at the time, and started studying toward the doctorate.
And the doctorate was in?
Religious education.
Religious education again.
Yes. Stayed in the same area. What I liked about that major, and really why I stayed with it, is that we had to demonstrate competence in a number of areas. Mm-hmm. So it was theology or religion, education, philosophy, and psychology.
Hmm. Interesting combination.
Yeah. And those were the kinds of majors that I was interested in. And we had two other areas, so we had to demonstrate competence in our prelims in six areas. And so it was a strong degree, and the training was rigorous and thorough. So again, I knew that I was preparing mm-hmm. myself to continue to do the kinds mm-hmm. of things that I had been doing mm-hmm. and was interested in. And so stayed there, and of course there were obviously some challenging times there, but I earned my degree.
Did you have to write a dissertation?
Yeah.
What did you write it on?
Suicidal behaviors of college students.
Oh, interesting. Why, oh my. Mm-hmm. I have to ask you, why did you choose that?
Well, in each of my jobs, remember I said that I had always done some counseling?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Right. I encountered problems that people had that we didn't have trained professionals in those days to work with them. A lot of small schools didn't have counselors on the staff. Mm-hmm. They had people who would be part-time counseling and teaching. And when I was at Spelman, as Dean of Women, obviously I would be the person that much of this would come mm-hmm, to. Mm-hmm. And I had had a couple of students who had serious psychological problems and a couple who were suicidal. Mm. So I talked to the college physician about the fact that we needed, since we didn't have a practicing psychotherapist or psychiatrist on campus, that we needed to develop some kind of relationship with someone external to the campus. And could he give me the names of several psychiatrists that he thought might be sensitive to the needs that we had? And so he said, yeah, I'll give him a few days and he'd give me some names. And so sure enough, he did. And I asked him of the two names that he gave me, which one did he think was most likely? And he thought both might be. So on the basis of that conversation, I went to see one of the psychiatrists and presented to him our situation and ask if there were some way that he would be willing, he and or members of his staff, would be willing to assist us by seeing some of these students. And I said, they don't have any money, so they can't pay. And the university can't pay you what the college can't pay you what you normally get for these kinds of sessions. But I was just wondering if perhaps they wouldn't consider that an opportunity for them to do some very valuable and much needed community service. he said to me that he hadn't thought of doing this before, but he was so impressed with me and what I had shared with him and understanding the need that he would do it. Hmm. And he said, but I have a condition. So I said, okay. He said, I would like for you to do a case study whenever you refer anybody to me. So I said, fine, I could do that. So he also didn't want me to just send him a slew of people. Mm-hmm. And I said, right. Of course not, I won't do that. I said, I'll only send you those that I think have the most serious problems and the ones that I think we're least prepared to mm-hmm. assist. So he said, okay. And so each time I referred a student, I wrote up this case study and I take them down because, you know, they weren't wanting to go mm-hmm. often. Mm-hmm. So I think I had referred maybe two, no more than three students. and had one who was seriously suicidal. So when I took the second or third student, I've forgotten which, the psychologist on his staff said, "Oh, Mercy, the doctor wants to see you today." So I said, "Oh, okay." And so she said, "Maybe we should have you come back, because I think he really wants to talk to you at some length." She said, "But let me just check with him and see." So I said, "Well, I could do that. I could schedule and then come back another time." So we decided on a time when we could meet, because I needed to take that student back. And in that conversation, he said, "Marcille, you have very natural abilities that we can't train you." And he said, "You ought to be a psychiatrist." Mm. That he had never seen anybody write up such accurate reports as I had. And that when he got the first one and read through it, he thought, "Wow." But they would then do the psychological tests. And he said, "In every case, what you wrote was confirmed by our tests." And he said, "That's just ability that you can't teach. This is a natural for you." So he wanted to talk to me about becoming a psychiatrist. And I said, "Well, that would require an awful lot." And he said, "But it would be worth it." And I said, "Well, what I'd have to do essentially is to go back and start taking science courses as an undergraduate, and then go to medical school, and then be on for the psychiatry." And he said, "Yes, that was true." And I said, "Well, I don't have the resources to do that." And he said, "We'll help you." So I said, "I don't know." And he said, "Well, think about it." And he said, "I want to tell you, Marcille, that either you should go back to school, get the training to become a psychiatrist, or you should give up this job and get married." Hmm. He said, "You have just wonderful skills. You're very effective, but you're working much too hard for somebody your age." I was not yet 30 at the time. And he said, "This is too much responsibility for somebody at your age to have. You ought to be out enjoying life." So he said, "But think about it. I'd really like to see you become a psychiatrist, because you just have this natural ability." So I thought about it and decided that that was not what I wanted to do. And so then, years later, I went to get the doctorate.
And you ended up doing that. That's very interesting. Well, we could go in that direction, but we won't, because it's so very intriguing. So you got your PhD, and then you went to teach in Kansas, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. When I finished my degree, and my degree is doesn't have the letters PhD, it's an EDRD.
EDRD.
You don't see those anymore.
Sure don't. I don't know if I've ever seen those, as a matter of fact.
Well, that's to distinguish it as being more than a doctorate in education. Oh. So it's a doctorate in religious education.
Oh, religion, of course. Yeah.
And it's been interesting, because a lot of people don't know what that means, but I've met people, you know, who say, "Oh, wow, that is quite a degree." And it is. So I knew, you know, that I was going to go on with the university affiliations and professional involvement. So that's why I decided to go back and get the doctorate.
And at Ottawa, you taught. What was your job at Ottawa? Were you teaching, basically?
Oh, well, let me. Yeah, but again, doing the same kinds of things that I mentioned.
The same kind of things that you've been doing before.
Excuse me, this is good. When I left Albany State College. So from Spelman, I went to Albany State College after we married,
mm-hmm.
and worked there as an associate dean of students, mm-hmm. so doing administration and counseling.
Mm-hmm.
And then left there, went to Hartford Seminary to work on mm-hmm. my doctorate. When I came back, now the president had assured me that when I came back, they would have a position for me. When I finished my degree and came back, he didn't have a position. Mm. And I wasn't altogether sure what that meant, but I thought, well, okay, if you don't have it, you don't have it. So for the first year after I completed the doctorate, I didn't work.
Mm.
And started then looking for other positions. And Sam Proctor came back, of course, into my life again. He'd never left. He was always there, checking and cheering me on. And we talked about what I'd like to do and where. And he called me one day and said, listen, I'm on a board of trustees of a good, small liberal arts college out in Kansas. And it'd be just perfect for you. And I've told them about you already. And they want you to come out for an interview. Would you do it? So I said, well, sure I'd go. And he said, they want both of you.
Hmm.
So I said, then we'll both go. So I, he said, here's the president's telephone number. I told him you'd call him within the hour. I said, Dr. Proctor, you're always putting me up to things like this. You don't give me any wiggle room. And he said, no, because I know what you'd do if I gave you some. So, actually, the president calls me and told me he heard these very impressive things about me, and it sounded like I was just the person that he was looking for, and that he also had a coaching position open mm. for my husband. And when could we come out for an interview? So we worked it out, went for the interview, and that was one of the most thorough interviews that I had ever had up until that point.
Your interview lasted the entire day and at Ottawa?
And at the end of the day, they offered me the job. saying that it just had been unanimous from every group that we had, who had interviewed us or visited with us. And so both of us were offered the jobs that we had interviewed for, and we moved to Kansas. Mm. And I was on the faculty there for 5 years, teaching psychology and psychology courses. And counseling.
Hmm.
And then...
pretty much exactly what you wanted to do, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Absolutely. Yeah. And then my husband took a job out here. I didn't join him for the first year. And then we decided to join him here.
So the long and winding road finally came to Madison, Wisconsin.
Right.
And this was in, what, 1974?
Five. Fall of 1975.
Okay.
And I came here without a job, with all kinds of promises from him that there were 3 positions mm. waiting for
mm-hmm.
me,
mm-hmm.
and of course, you know, that was not true. After a while, I knew that I had to conduct my first job search, truly, in my life, and thought about ways to do that, but then met again a person who said that he was very impressed with me. This was the brother-in-law of George Crist,
mm-hmm.
whose name is John Reichert.
Mm-hmm.
John was working in the School of Education's extramural department, and it was Korean Technical Education, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Strong was the director.
Merle Strong?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So John drove the recreational van that took the wives of football coaches to games out of town. We were on our way to Ohio State for a game. And his wife said to me in the van, "I want to tell you something, but you have to keep it in confidence." And I said, "Oh, okay." She said, "My husband's very impressed with you. And he says he's going to help you find a job." She said, "So when he tells you when we get there, you should act surprised." And I said, "Oh, I can do that." And sure enough, when we got there, he said to me the same thing she told me he was going to say. And that if I could impress others as quickly as I had impressed him, and he was hard to impress, then we shouldn't have any difficulty finding a job for me. That Madison was a tough job market, but he knew that there were lots of places where I could work. Little did I know that John was going to call me on Monday when we got back that weekend and said, "Okay, let's get to work." And we talked about, you know, what kinds of jobs I might be interested in. And he said, "All right, here are some names, and you contact them." And he said, "Some of them are going to tell you that they don't have a job available. And when they say that, they will not want to see you." And he said, "But you want to see them. So you say, 'I understand that you don't have a job available, but I'd still like to come in and talk to you. I'm new to the community. I don't know the university very well, that I have worked on small campuses, and so I'm just needing to get acquainted and begin to understand the university here.'"
Wise advice.
That yes,
really
it
good.
Was.
You were very fortunate. You had people giving you really good
yes,
advice
throughout my life. Yeah. And so I would get these things set up during the day, and then he'd call me at the end of the day and said, "Okay, how did it go?" And we'd process what had happened with my reactions, and we'd work on another list. And so I was seeing people here at the university, at system, and in state government. And whenever I saw anybody not connected with the university, they couldn't understand why I didn't already have a job at the university. And they would say, "You know, what's happening to people over there? How can they let somebody, you know, like you be here and not have you on that campus?" And so they would make calls and say to people, "You know, I just met somebody today that you need to know."
Mm-hmm.
And so people would refer me to somebody else and to somebody else and to somebody else. And finally, the position in Paul Ginsberg's office was announced. And I had decided.
Oops, Ginsberg.
Okay.
Okay.
So I had calls from several people telling me about this position, and I had decided at that point that I would not apply for it because I had moved out of student services into a faculty position, mm-hmm. and I preferred to continue mm-hmm. with a faculty appointment. But of course was learning in the process that that would not come easily here. One, because of my major being an interdisciplinary one, or my area of specialization being interdisciplinary, and two, that I had not done any research.
Mm-hmm.
But in the within the same kind of time frame that the position in the Dean of Students office was opened, there was also one in what was called at that time the School of Allied Health Professions. So I thought, you know, well, that's one that I should look at as well. And Phil Perrone in counseling had talked to me. And then I was going to have an appointment with Pat Rundy in the School of Allied Health Professions. But at any rate, I hadn't planned to pursue the Dean of Students position as an assistant Dean of Students, because I'd done that before, and I was ready to move
on. Been there, done that type thing, right.
And then I got a couple of calls from people saying, you know, I wish you would consider applying for that position, because they have never had a person with your qualifications in that office, and we think there's a need for it. And these were both white and black folks calling me and saying, please consider it. Well, the salary was also lower than I wanted to consider at that time. But at any rate, I decided, well, it can't hurt, and so I'll take a look at it. So sent in my stuff. Papers, I shouldn't say stuff, sent in my application. That's the way it feels sometimes. And I was invited for an interview, came over, and was interviewed by Paul's staff, several assistant deans. And I think it was at the end of the day or the next day, Paul called me at home and said that he wanted to offer me the job. And I said, but you and I have not met. And he said he didn't need to meet me. And I said, how can you offer me a job if we've not met? And so then he told me that about his staff. And he said that they were all highly capable and very professional, and that they had never been unanimous in any decision before. But they all were on offering me the job. He said, I've not seen such excitement from the staff as I have heard when they talked about you. So I need to see you. And I said, well, but I need to meet with you. I said, I couldn't accept a job without meeting the person who's going to be my immediate supervisor. So he said, well, okay. So we set up the time when I would come over to meet with him. I came, we talked, and he said, my staff is right. So I'm still offering you the job. So I asked him how long I had to consider it, and he told me, and I said, okay, I would get back to him. So I did, and within 2 weeks after I had accepted that job, I had a call from Allied Health offering me the position there, which would have included some teaching. It wouldn't be a tenure track faculty position, but I could do teaching and administration. And I was sorely tempted, but I had already accepted for position in the Dean of Students office, and I thought I had to say no to that.
Isn't that funny how fate goes sometimes?
And so I joined the Dean of Students.
What was your initial impression of Dean Ginsberg?
Oh, I liked him immediately. Paul is very engaging, kind of a warm fuzzy. He puts people at ease quickly in his presence, but he still has that kind of penetrating gaze. And you know that he's taking in lots of information beyond what he's hearing with the words. And since I had met the staff, I was impressed with them, and you know, I thought that there was the kind of diversity and talents, interests and abilities that I would enjoy working with. And so I did.
I think this is probably, you have an appointment coming in pretty soon. We're at a nice place to cut, so why don't we stop here and we'll pick it up from here next time. You're now fully a member of the UW team, so this is a good place to call it quits for the day. Thank you. Okay.